Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, September 12, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be having a conversation on politics and federal antitrust enforcement. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I am the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we have with us John Leibowitz, partner at Davis Polk & Wardwell LLP and former chair of the Federal Trade Commission. We also have Bill Kovesic, global competition professor of law and policy and director at the Competition Law Center at the George Washington University Law School and former chair of the Federal Trade Commission. We have Seth Bloom, president and founder of Bloom Strategic Counsel PLLC and former general counsel of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee Antitrust Subcommittee. Also, Tad Lipsky, former senior Federal Trade Commission U.S. Justice Department Antitrust Division official and retired partner, Latham & Watkins. And today our moderator is Dick Stoyer, Senior Counsel, Mayor Brown LLP, and former Chair of the American Bar Association Antitrust Section. After our speakers give their remarks, we'll move to an audience Q&A. Thank you for speaking with us, Dick. The floor is now yours.
Thank you, Wesley. And a shout-out to Adam Beagle of Alston & Byrd for putting this teleforum together. Ever since the Sherman Act was adopted back in 1890, there's been some disagreement over whether the purpose of the antitrust law should be confined to consumer welfare, that is, preventing anti-competitive acts that result in higher prices, or whether more politically charged purposes, such as protecting small businesses and limiting the accumulation of political power, should be included as well. By the 1970s, consumer welfare emerged as the sole objective of antitrust, and enforcers from both parties have come to endorse this view. We heard this expressed during the Obama administration by Edith Ramirez, the chair of the Federal Trade Commission, and by Bill Baer, the head of the Antitrust Division. And we just heard it again from Maureen Olhausen, who is presently chairing the Federal Trade Commission. But not all countries agree with this. In many countries, the review of mergers and other potentially anti-competitive activities consider not only consumer welfare, but other so-called national interest or public interest factors. These countries include China, which has been attracting a lot of attention, but also include countries like Canada, Australia, Germany, and South Africa. Now there is growing debate in the United States over whether the inclusion of public interest considerations should be made in antitrust enforcement. Amazon's acquisition of Whole Foods was met with calls for stricter enforcement, and this summer, antitrust was a centerpiece of the Democrats' Better Way proposal. Meanwhile, draft legislation has been in the works from both Republicans and Democrats, and some legislation already has been introduced. Some of these proposals involve expanding the scope of CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, to consider not only military security, but also public interest, particularly where American assets are being acquired by foreign state-owned enterprises or sovereign wealth funds. So what is public interest? Well, today the chief concerns have been creating and preserving jobs and curbing foreign control of domestic firms that are considered strategic. But concentration of political power, income disparity, and protecting small business are still in the mix. There really are three issues that are facing every country looking at this today. First, whether to include public interest considerations at all in the review of mergers, acquisitions, and practices that impact competition. If these considerations are included, who should conduct the reviews? Is it the Competition Commission or another agency? And if more than one agency is involved, should they have a veto over one another? Or should every one of them be able to veto the deal or the practice? This has become not just a competition issue today, but a trade issue. Are nations treating each other fairly? Should antitrust standards be specified in trade agreements like NAFTA? And we know that those negotiations are going on right now. And as a policy matter, who is each government trying to protect? Its companies? its consumers, its workers, its tax base. The president's senior advisor, Stephen Miller, recently said, "Our question as a government is, to whom is our duty? Our duty is to U.S. citizens and U.S. workers to promote rising wages for them." Now, he said this in the context of immigration, but the issue arises at least as much in the context of competition law. Even the most ardent opponents of public interest standards have to confront the concern that if their own nation reviews mergers and other competition issues only on the basis of a consumer welfare standard, while other nations review them on the basis of a range of public interest standards, including where the best jobs, research labs, and factories are going to be positioned, the global playing field might not be level. And if a country decides to include public interest factors in reviewing deals and competitive practices, the question it faces is how to do it. Have one agency do the whole review? Two agencies? Three agencies? Almost every imaginable approach is being followed today in one country or another, and right now I'm co-chairing a task force for the ABA antitrust section to find out just how well each of these approaches has actually been working in practice. So here's the issue to confront today. Does the introduction of public interest considerations into antitrust reviews threaten to politicize antitrust enforcement decisions? Or is U.S. antitrust disserving the public interest today by excluding consideration of jobs, foreign control, and other public interest factors? And as a matter of trade policy, can we continue to have some nations include public interest factors while the U.S. excludes those factors? We have four extraordinarily qualified panelists to discuss these issues today, and let me turn it over to John to kick it off.
Thank you so much, Dick. I thought your introduction was terrific, but I do want to sort of step back a little bit and talk about sort of the role of politics and antitrust and what politics might mean. So if you mean by what's the role of politics and antitrust, and if by that you mean antitrust philosophy, then it's a philosophy towards antitrust, then I think it's totally appropriate. A president gets to choose his heads of agencies. So, for example, we saw a more activist antitrust division under Bill Baer than we did we would expect to see under Tom Barnett. And the role of politics as a sort of, you know, or the concern about bigness goes back, you know, more than a century, as you pointed out, Dick, really to the Sherman Act and before. Brandeis, who was one of the architects of the Federal Trade Commission, told a congressional committee in 1912, and I just am going to read a small excerpt, and this was hearings before a special House investigative committee on the power of the steel industry, and I quote, "We can't maintain democratic conditions in America if we allow organizations to arise in our midst with the power of the United States Steel Corporation. Liberty of the American citizen can't endure against such organizations." And that's a statement of Louis Brandeis in those hearings. And so if you're talking about that kind of politics, a sort of philosophy or a philosophy towards antitrust, that seems reasonable and a good discussion, an appropriate discussion to have. If you mean sort of the raw politics as applied to antitrust, like Lyndon Johnson telling the Houston Chronicle publisher that he would get his bank merger approved, the publisher of the Houston Chronicle also owned a local bank, if the Chronicle endorsed LBJ in the 64 election, you know, or a president requiring a would-be nominee to commit to approving or disapproving a merger, you know, that seems to me beyond totally inappropriate. That seems like clearly corrupt. Now, recently, we've had a sort of a wave of concern about concentration, particularly among Democratic thinkers. And again, you know, my sense is that's a useful discussion to have. I happen to believe that we don't want to go back to the days, Seth, you may disagree with me, of Vaughn's Groceries or P&G Clorox. Because that kind of antitrust thinking really doesn't benefit consumers. Consumer welfare is obviously critical to the essence of antitrust. But it's also true that antitrust is about choice as well as economics, and we sometimes lose sight of that. And then there's also no doubt that bigness and political influence are legitimate topics in an American conversation. I'm not so sure how much of it should be put into – I'm not so sure how much of it should be integral to antitrust, but it's an important topic. And I just started to read Franklin Foer's book, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. And, you know, there's no doubt that some large technology companies and I represent Davis Polk represents some of them do exert an awful lot of influence, you know, and as Frank says, emphasize convenience over contemplation. But if you ask me whether the FTC should have blocked Amazon from buying Whole Foods, you know, the answer would be no. That deal, and we don't represent Amazon. That deal actually seems to provide benefits to consumers. Just walk into a Whole Foods in the last 2 weeks and look at all the sales or all the discounting that you never saw at Whole Foods before. And if you ask me, I'm just going back to one point you raised earlier. If you ask me whether we should have a public interest test for antitrust reviews, you know, I think that's a really dangerous idea. It is too unanchored from empirical evidence, and you know, would result in a lot less consistency in antitrust reviews. I think the thing to do, and the most important thing, is to vigorously enforce the antitrust laws. And not that the agencies are perfect. And if you ask me, I'd probably say over my 8.5 years at the FTC, there are probably 3 or 4 votes I'd like to have back. Or have do-overs on. Leslie, you didn't have to vote in the antitrust division. It's a unitary executive. But I do believe that you want a consistency and you want vigorous enforcement. That's good. And then finally, I'll just take 30 seconds and I'll talk a little bit about foreign antitrust authorities. And here, there is no doubt that some of those authorities, not most of them, but some of them tend to use antitrust as a fig leaf for industrial policy. And the more successful the American company in their crosshairs or the more unsuccessful and sort of iconic local champion, the more likely that that the thumb is going to be on the scale against the American corporation. In the crosshairs, it's often good politics in other countries, antitrust agencies, I think, need to make this a very high priority going forward, and they maybe need to enlist sort of more aspects, more components of government, including the USTR and the White House. That's a complicated equation, and I'm not or dynamic, and I'm not quite sure if I have a strong position on it yet, but I do believe it is critically important for this to be a high priority going forward. Maureen Allhouse and Terrell McSweeney at the FTC have done a very good job of raising the profile on this issue as appropriate, and I have no doubt that Megan Delrahim, when he gets to the antitrust division, will also make that a high priority. So. With that, I will stop bloviating, and I will turn it over to the next panelist.
Thanks, John. I think next we're going to hear from Bill.
Oh, thanks, Dick. Is there politics in antitrust? Inevitably, you can't imagine that a country would give a great deal of power and money to a public institution without demanding some degree of accountability. If you didn't have some accountability to the political process, you wouldn't have a system that's seen as legitimate. There's not a country in the world that gives the major regulatory authority this kind of mandate, budget, or significance without asking important questions about how it's being used. The area in which I think you would like to protect the autonomy of the agency is when it does things that really hurts. To allow it to make decisions to prosecute or not prosecute, to sanction or not sanction, without the specific direction of political officials. If you allow political officials, as John was just saying, to reward friends and punish enemies through the application of the antitrust process, it becomes an instrument for the capricious exercise of power by elected officials, and it becomes a focal point for capture, where well-financed interest groups of all kinds will march into the executive branch or the legislature to be used in a particular way. That's the political interference that has to be fought off, I think, at all costs. But to be accountable for basic policy judgment and have a boring conversation with elected officials, you do have to answer correctly, is an entirely legitimate. So is there politics and antitrust? Inevitably. But is there a domain in which the decisions of the agencies should be free from explicit direction by public officials and control? Absolutely. And if you lose that, then you lose confidence ultimately on the part of citizens, investors, business people, that the system is legitimate. What does public interest really mean? I think it's important to note that the position of an antitrust agency is an awkward one. Do citizens like competition? Sometimes. As consumers, when they go to buy goods and services, they do. Better prices, better product quality, a variety of different services. Do they like it as workers? Not so much. Individual citizens, I think, like a measure of stability that comes with a good job that pays well. If you have a choice between working for a monopolist that shares lots of benefits with you as an employee, or a worker in a highly competitive sector that has to run for their life day in and day out, I'll choose the monopolist. The monopolist is a much more comfortable place to be. The fact is that competition politically is very destructive by design. It displaces. It destroys sectors. It creates new ones. And the communities that have firms that are falling to pieces, how would you like to have been an employee at Eastman Kodak in the end? At one time, it was a global titan. Now it's gone. Competition destroyed that firm and others like it. The competition agency is in the very awkward position of arguing that in the long term, that's beneficial. In the short term, it generates benefits, and that we should accept the process of regeneration that brings new firms into being to replace those that go. I think if we ask what role should the agency have specifically in providing assistance or protection to people who are already employed in sectors that are going to be turned upside down, arguably we have much better policy instruments to do that. And should a great nation in some way soften the blow of these kinds of transitions? Sure. I think that discontent was evident in the last election, as it has been in other countries as well. But is the competition agency in the best position to provide that kind of protection and buffering? Arguably not. It's pretty damned hard just to do the basic microeconomic policy analysis before trying to do trade-offs that involve other values as well. I think if you go to countries that have adopted explicit public interest standards to protect, for example, historically disadvantaged groups, you find that this is enormously difficult for them. And you have desirable efforts such as in South Africa with the Competition Commission of South Africa to lay out guidelines that explain how we do trade-offs, how we trade off a loss of competition for an increase in jobs or commitments to provide mobility for historically excluded groups. They've tried to provide guidance about how to do that, but it's a frightfully hard job to start balancing additional factors. At a minimum, if one is going to do it, one would beg for clarity and disclosure about how those choices are being made so you can have a debate about how those take place. I'd add, too, that I think when you look at the portfolio of what agencies have done, competition authorities, you find that maybe not by design, a huge amount of what they do, in fact, has significant benefits for the second half of the income distribution. In all of my time in appearing before legislators with budgets and looking back at the FTC's budget proposals, going back to the mid-1960s, the FTC always went to Congress and said, our programs seek to protect the ordinary individual citizen. What are we worried about? We're worried about food, we're worried about energy, we're worried about health care, to take three priorities. The FTC isn't saying we're worried about consumers of luxury yachts expensive luxury goods. We're worried first and foremost about ordinary citizens. So it might not have been the express aim of all antitrust policy, but when you look at the basic agenda of competition authorities going back over decades, and you look at what they do day in and day out, an extraordinary amount of their programs focus benefits on those with lesser incomes, those in positions of less power. Whether it's the advocacy process by which they seek to make certain goods and services more widely acceptable to people with low incomes, whether it's the selection of individual cases, the prosecution of specific matters, I would argue that the majority of what they do day in and day out tends to have specific advantages for people with lesser incomes. A last thing to think about in thinking about an expansion of the agency's role is to look carefully at past episodes when agencies have been exhorted to do more. My first time at the FTC was a period at the end of a decade in which the FTC had been exhorted to do far more with respect to concentration as an end in itself, concentrated sectors, shared monopoly cases, and others. And the history of that experience is pretty grim. The FTC's efforts had some hits, but a terrible, terrible number of failures. And I think failures rooted in two things. First, a lack of capacity to do 5, 6, 7, 8 bet your agency cases at one. But second, if you're not careful about how many major economic forces you take on at once, and it's a tough judgment, you generate political backlash that poses a threat to the very existence of the agency itself. The FTC was on the ropes in 1979 and 1980 before Ronald Reagan ever came to Washington. And it was Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale, through the voice of Walter Mondale, who went to Battle Creek, Michigan on the day before the presidential balloting in 1980 and told the citizens of Battle Creek, the headquarters of Kellogg, if you will vote for us, we will take specific steps to make sure that the Federal Trade Commission's shared monopoly case against the cereal sector is disabled, and those companies will never be broken up.
Well, thank you, Bill. Our next speaker is going to be Seth Bloom. Seth?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dick, and the Federal Society for the invitation to speak in this panel and with this august group of my colleagues, and I also would like to say that all my comments are my own, not reflecting any client's view. Well, I think obviously now is a very good time to be talking about this subject, given all the political ferment around antitrust these days, which we haven't seen in a long time, and including the better deal put out by Senator Schumer and Leader Pelosi. But I mean, I think before getting into the questions you asked, I want to begin with, in a similar way as John did, about whether or not politics should even be involved in antitrust. You know, you hear that a lot because sort of antitrust practitioners, people in the antitrust business, sometimes what I call the antitrust priesthood, is at times horrified by the idea that politics could play a role. I mean, this is supposed to be a very specialized, economically based, high-level enterprise. Why should we let petty political considerations play a role? And it should be based on economics. It should be apolitical. You hear that all the time. I think there are two things to be said about this, and John said a lot of this, so I'm going to repeat to some extent what he did, but we didn't coordinate, so we didn't collaborate, it being good antitrust people. There's a certain type of political influence I think that we can all agree is not appropriate, and that is intervening on behalf of campaign donors to squash an antitrust investigation or action. You know, President Nixon in the ITT case in the early 1970s was accused of doing that, and that played a small role in the Watergate scandal. There are questions raised about our current president and whether or not he's made statements against the AT&T Time Warner merger because he doesn't like CNN's coverage of him. And Bill told a very good story just a few minutes ago. So, I mean, I think we can all agree that that's not an appropriate exercise of political forces. because it makes antitrust entirely arbitrary and subject to those kinds of political influences. On the other hand, I think there are very many legitimate political ways to influence the antitrust enforcement process. You know, the antitrust laws are not the Ten Commandments handed down in Mount Sinai. They were written by flesh and blood politicians, Senator Sherman, Senator Clayton, and others, and they are very much part of the political process at their origin in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And it's entirely appropriate that they should be subject to political checks as any other body of law, whether it's civil rights law or environmental law, you name it, labor law. And there's nothing sacred about antitrust, and there's nothing that should remove it from, you know, political influence. And that's why whether or not one agrees with this Better Deal document, for example, that Senator Schumer and Leader Pelosi and others just put out in a month or so ago, I think it's entirely appropriate for these issues to be debated in the political spectrum. And antitrust should not be immune from political influence. And in fact, you know, as John pointed out, it's not. You know, the president appoints antitrust officials, commissioners of the FTC, head of the antitrust division, other senior antitrust officials. And so in that way, you know, the president exercises properly, you know, a political direction over the enforcement of antitrust laws. The other thing is the antitrust laws themselves are very vague. For this notion that it's somehow a specialized something like the tax code, which only the specialists are the province of, when you have terms like substantial lessening of competition in Clayton Act Section 7 and a conspiracy or combination restraint of trade in the basic Sherman Act Section 1, you know, what does that mean? It can mean 1,000 different things, or it can mean 9 different things if there's 9 Supreme Court justices. So because of the vagueness of the law, it lends itself to discretion and enforcement. And because it lends itself to discretion of enforcement, it's legitimate for non-corrupt political factors to play a role. So, you know, one thing that I'd like to talk a little bit about is I spent almost 14 years on the staff of the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee. We held over 50 hearings involving mergers and other allegations of anti-competitive conditions. And, you know, I remember I once was in a panel discussion with Judge Ginsburg of the D.C. Circuit, a distinguished judge, you know, a legal scholar, but he was really horrified by the idea that we on the antitrust subcommittee were looking at mergers that should, his view was that it should be the province of either the antitrust division or the FTC. And frankly, I disagree with that. And I think we, in many occasions, not to toot my own horn, but I think we did a public service. If you think about when there's a public hearing at the Senate or the House in Congress, it makes this very untransparent process transparent. It's an opportunity for advocates of a merger or critics of a merger or consumer groups to have their feelings aired. And the agencies, the enforcement agencies, I think, notice it. And then often these mergers are followed by letters from the senators or the representatives, you know, and with their conclusions and with their points of, you know, you ought to look at this before approving, et cetera. On some rare occasion, you ought to block this merger. I think that's entirely appropriate. Now, not to say that just because a letter is written from Congress that the agency is going to follow it, but it's something that they ought to pay attention to. And, you know, the best example in my mind in my time in the Senate was in 2011 when we looked at the AT&T T-Mobile merger. And at the time we looked at it in May, merger had been announced a few months earlier. It was thought to be inevitable that it was going to go through. And I think our hearing was the first bump in the road for the merger, and we had the CEOs of AT&T and T-Mobile testify, including Randall Stephenson, the CEO of AT&T, who said, "We don't compete with T-Mobile." And that was just met with derision, both by my boss at the time, Senator Cole, and other people, by the media. And I think with that hearing and his performance was the first cracks in the inevitability of the merger. We then later wrote a letter a couple months later saying the merger should be blocked to the Justice Department and the FCC. Now, they blocked it. Was it because of our letter? I'm not going to say it was because of our letter, but I just think it was a matter of creating the climate. And I think that's a constructive way, which you might call politics, of getting involved in antitrust enforcement. So my bottom line is I think in a proper way, politics can play a role. Now, I'll just finish with, you know, the discussion that you brought up, Dick, about the efforts public interest standard into antitrust, or some people believe it should be, or look at issues like jobs. I'm not a great fan of that. And I think Bill brought this up. You know, I think the biggest reason for that is, you know, if you make antitrust subject to a public interest standard, it's going to very much depend on what the administration is. So we would expect to see You know, if we had a President Bernie Sanders or a President Elizabeth Warren and their administration would be enforcing the antitrust laws under a public interest standard very differently than if it was a Mike Pence administration or a Ted Cruz administration. And I think that kind of thing leads to such variability in antitrust enforcement that it would really diminish from antitrust would become increasingly arbitrary and depending on who's running things. And so I think that alone is a reason to be cautious about trying to have such a broad public interest standard. With that, I think I'll stop my discussion and turn it over to the next panelist.
Thanks, Seth. Our next panelist is Tad.
Well, with those, I have to say, absolutely superb presentations, including, of course, Richard's introduction. I really have to foreshorten my contribution somewhat and put in some arguably unique points. And they're very brief, and I would put them as follows. First of all, we live in an era when somehow there is such squeamishness about the White House and what it says to the Justice Department and other aspects of the law enforcement bureaucracy. We have to remember that the Constitution makes the president the chief magistrate, and he is in charge of that process. And those of you who love Nino Scalia's dissent in Morrison versus Olson and don't like the majority opinion that approved the independent counsel law on those particular facts will agree with me, and if not. But we shouldn't blithely assume that presidential determination of case outcomes or prosecutions is a bad thing. And Seth, I'm very happy referred to a well-known example of probably a not-so-good intervention. Those of you who have maintained copies of the transcripts of the Watergate tapes will see a kind of a Dick Nixon at his lowest calling up the Department of Justice and asking for all kinds of retribution against Dick McLaren for challenging what was then the largest merger in corporate history, which is ITT's acquisition of Hartford Fire. But if you want to see a shining knight on a white charger, none other than Attorney General John Mitchell, who, of course, later went to jail for various Watergate sins, saying, well, Mr. President, you can't just, plow in and dictate the result in a particular case. The public won't stand for it, and it's not proper. So good for you, John Mitchell. But on the other hand, the correct version of how the Department of Justice criminal price-fixing investigation into airfare fixing by air carriers on the North Atlantic routes is that Margaret Thatcher, when Ronald Reagan was president, wanted desperately to bring competition to a whole range of British industries. When she got into office, the very ossified and horrendously protected UK coal mining industry employed a million people, most of them supporters of labor, if not socialists, and members of the very active unions in that sector. I think I read the other day that employment in the UK coal sector is down to about 6,000, incidentally. And one of her targets was British Airways, which was costing was mostly, if not entirely, government-owned and was costing the hard-pressed UK government a fortune in various forms of subsidy and support. And so she said to Ronald Reagan, it is reputed, I think reliably, please, it will be almost impossible for me to privatize British Airways with the looming threat of class action treble damage liability that will almost certainly result if this investigation is continued and if it should produce indictments. So Ronald Reagan called the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice objected. Ronald Reagan overruled them. The grand jury was dismissed. The Department of Justice even put out a press release describing the grounds on which the grand jury had been dismissed and complaining about it and putting the responsibility directly on the president. The Republic still stands. The Department of Justice remained functional, as did antitrust enforcement. And it's a reminder of the fact that we have a constitutional system that allows the president a great deal of leeway with regard to questions of investigation and prosecution. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's a question of what are the reasons. And that was a shining example of somebody making the judgment that, on balance, considering all the interests and the competition interests, after all, it was a trade-off between enforcement against a past cartel and the possibility of having one of the largest, if not the largest, passenger air carrier transferred from state ownership to private ownership. So a difficult decision that I think President Reagan made well, and there might be similar future decisions. But in general, I would certainly agree that that Nixon's ITT phone call was exactly the wrong kind of intervention. And I'm grateful that at least according to the official story, it was never carried out. In fact, ITT was forced to divest Hartford, and at that time, I believe it was the largest divestiture in history, in a merger case at least. One other quick comment, in an effort to supplement the tremendous insight that has already been contributed to the call by others. An issue of rapidly increasing interest in the world of global antitrust enforcement is the question of antitrust procedures. Are companies railroaded? Are they subject to unfair procedures that force them to capitulate or that unfairly or incorrectly determine that they're guilty of antitrust crimes? Are massive billion-dollar fines against technology companies based on legitimate antitrust grounds or something else? If you have a system that allows you to consider something else, it's almost impossible to determine what the grounds of decision actually were, and therefore it's extremely difficult to tell whether the process that was applied is leading to a proper result. So that's another reason for making sure that the question of what is the effect of conduct on competition is answered very clearly, succinctly, and all by itself. Not to say that there aren't other interests like national security or some other interest that a country could properly care about, but I think the consensus emerging is that unless you require those other interests to be considered through distinct sets of rules and institutions, you have mucked up your antitrust process to the point where you are not even able to defend it on the grounds that it has clear criteria for decision and a clear procedure for resolving cases on the evidence and the arguments and the economics and the law. And that, I think, will be a tragedy for any antitrust system that fails to abide by that. We probably can't achieve perfection, and indeed, I don't think the American system achieves perfection, but there are some jurisdictions around the world very significant in the picture of antitrust, whether they bring abuse of dominance cases against leading technology firms, whether they evaluate mergers or other business arrangements. They're extremely significant. They do not limit their antitrust review to making a competition-based determination. I think that's very unfortunate, and I'm a big supporter of the rising calls for a more, I think John Leibowitz was the first on the call to mention this, but for more activist U.S. International participation in trying to get the world to come closer to convergence on some of these basic principles so that we focus on competition, we provide adequate antitrust procedure, and therefore a common and readily applicable standard of judgment can be placed on all antitrust proceedings, regardless of the jurisdiction they take place in. So I agree with John that the institutional means for that are very much subject to debate. To me, the obvious step one is to have some device or institution or procedure to get two U.S. antitrust agencies on exactly the same page and get the remainder of the administration on that page. To me, that's step one, and I hope we'll see that occur sooner rather than later. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Ted. Wesley, do you want to see if there are questions from those who are listening?
Absolutely. Let's go ahead and move to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor and present a question, please enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone. While we wait for any audience questions, Dick, is there anything that you'd like to bring up, discuss, or ask our panelists?
Yes, let me raise a question. One item that has been getting some traction is the notion that there should be a somewhat different standard for acquisitions by state-owned enterprises and sovereign wealth funds. There was a letter that went to the GAO last year from 16 members of Congress, including both Democrat and Republican members, asking for a study of this. There was also a government group studying China that suggested this, and there is legislation in Congress. The question is, should there be a different standard for reviewing acquisitions by foreign state-owned enterprises and sovereign wealth funds? Do any of our panelists have a view on that?
This is John Leibowitz, and I'll try to weigh in. I have not reviewed the SOE legislation, but I would say I would be very wary of changing the standards for particular industries or particular types of ownership, since for the most part, consumer welfare really shouldn't be affected by that by the nature of the ownership, and to the extent it is, I think that can already be contemplated under existing Clayton Act review. And then, you know, the other thing is, while I think as all the panelists and Ted mentioned, particularly a moment ago. While all the panelists agree that with respect to foreign competition authorities not giving American companies due process, that that's a critically important issue, I would worry that if we started to make changes for the standards for foreign SOEs, that would be a justification for making other changes abroad. And this was a lesson really that Bill Kovacic always reminded me of, when I asked him to read speeches and think about some of the talks I was giving, remember what the effect would be on foreign competition authorities. And I would worry as well that the effect on competition authorities would not inure to the benefit of the United States and really to consumers everywhere.
Well, let me follow up with a related question, which is in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the ill-fated Trans-Pacific Partnership, there was a provision on signatories having competition laws based on efficiency and notions of consumer welfare. And, of course, NAFTA is being renegotiated now. To some extent, this is a trade process in negotiating these terms. What would you want to see put into a trade agreement as a competition or antitrust term to be followed by all of the signatories? Anybody?
Dick, this is Bill. I it's valuable to encourage nations to adopt competition laws and to participate in the international process by which one tries to achieve some agreement about basic standards. But once you start to incorporate specific substantive provisions into the treaties, I think you get into a real mess in application. That is, what does it mean to say you have to take efficiencies into concern? How much do the U.S. agencies take efficiencies into concern? Analysis do you expect will occur in individual cases? I think you'd have to think very carefully about what kind of mandate you'd want to put in place. I think by contrast, the effort of the U.S. in international free trade agreements, Singapore is an example where Singapore has a competition law because the United States demanded it in the free trade agreement with that country. I think to require perhaps the adoption of a law, the application of law, with supplemental efforts to provide assistance and how that's applied and guidance about doing it. I'm extremely wary of starting to build into the treaty the specific roster of individual considerations that have to be taken into account. It leads you in the direction, I think, of having to specify how they're taken into account. How do you weigh it against other factors? I think it's not a wise move.
Anyone else? And of course, I know that's a topic for groups like the ICN and the OECD to be discussing on a very different level, but also a very productive one. Wesley, do we have any questions?
Looks like there are no questions pending in the queue right now, but I do want to inform our audience that our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow at 1 p.m. It will be titled Antitrust Implications of Pharmaceutical Pricing from Martin Shkreli to EpiPen. Please keep an eye out for future Teleforum calls, and you can find all this information on our website, fedsoc.org. Dick, is there any other subject or questions you'd like to bring up with our panelists before we close today?
Well, I think they've done a marvelous job of very concisely addressing all of the major issues on this topic. I think that we haven't heard the last word because there is a great deal of interest in antitrust and politics right now, and it's a topic for all of us to keep an eye on.
Wonderful. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.